nothing in the world like being poor. You go and knock on every door. You people of means will never know. There's nothing in the world like being poor.
This is your announcer, Shy John, here on the Kill Radio Weekly News with a special report. Today's report from 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, The War on Poverty, A Deep Divide on How to Help. This is by David Wellna, NPR, January 12th. All this week, Majority Leader Harry Reid declared over and over on the Senate floor that there's a downside to the recovering economy. It's true, he said. The rich are getting a lot richer, and the poor are getting poorer. That observation may not be surprising coming from a Democrat. Less expected, perhaps, is a similar lament made the same day by the Senate's Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. We all know the stock market's been doing great, so the richest among us are doing just fine, McConnell said, but what about the poor? What about working class folks? Those comments came on the same week a study showed more than half the members of Congress are millionaires. Still, Susan Collins, a Senate Republican up for re-election in Maine, insists members of both parties are compassionate and that they do agree that income inequality is a real issue, that the lack of jobs is a serious problem. The question is, what do we do about it, she asks. The two parties' deep differences over dealing with these issues were readily apparent on Wednesday, the 50th anniversary of President Johnson's declaration of a war on poverty. Democrat Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii called that effort a success. The national poverty rate has gone down from 26% in 1967 to 16% in 2012, she said. Without safety net programs, the poverty rate would have climbed to 29%. But Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida marked the anniversary with a speech in Johnson's old Senate office, highlighting the continued problems of poverty. They will not be solved by continuing with the same stale Washington ideas, he said. 5 decades and trillions of dollars after President Johnson first announced the war on poverty, the results of the big government approach are in. In an interview with NBC's Brian Williams, another Republican, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, was asked what grade he'd give the war on poverty. I would give us a failing grade, he answered. It has failed. We should have done better than this. We can do better than this. Both Ryan and Rubio want more local control over anti-poverty programs. Meanwhile, the Senate is debating whether Congress should restore jobless benefits to more than 1 million long-term unemployed people who lost them 2 weeks ago. McConnell voted to block the aid. Because it's only when you believe that government is the answer to all of your problems that you talk about unemployment insurance instead of job creation, McConnell said. Most Senate Republicans voted to block extending the unemployment payments, invoking fiscal rectitude. John Hoeven is a Republican from North Dakota, the state with the nation's lowest unemployment. You've got to find a way to pay for these programs so we don't keep increasing the debt and deficit which hurts the economy, Hoeven said. Democrats say extending unemployment benefits actually helps the economy, in addition to those who receive them. Their next goal is to raise the federal minimum wage. That won't be forgotten come election time, says New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer. The issue of which party can address the needs of the middle class and the decline in income and the need for better paying jobs is going to win the election, plain and simple, Schumer said. Not the party that, you know, figures out the best solution on Obamacare, and not the party that figures out the best solution on the deficit. This is the issue. The world is changing. Copyright 2014 NPR. To see more, visit www.npr.org. Okay, now, next up in the news, I have something here from Slate.com. This article is entitled, Social Darwinism Isn't Dead. Rich People Think They Really Are Different From You and Me, by Matthew Hudson. London's Mayor Boris Johnson drew criticism late last year for saying that economic inequality can be attributed in part to IQ. I am afraid that the violent economic centrifuge of competition is operating on human beings who are already very far from equal in raw ability, he told an audience at the Center for Policy Studies. That's a satisfying worldview for someone who is successful and considers himself unusually bright. But a quick look at the data shows the limitations of raw smarts and stick-to-itiveness as an explanation for inequality. The income distribution in the United States provides a good example. In 2012, the top 0.01% of households earned an average of $10.25 million, while the mean household income for the country overall was $51,000. Our top earners, 200 times as smart as the rest of the field? Doubtful. Do they have the capacity to work 200 times more hours in the week? Even more doubtful. Many forces out of their control, including sheer luck, are at play. But say you're in that top 0.01%, or even the top 50%. Would you want to admit happenstance as a benefactor? Wouldn't you rather believe that you earned your wealth, that you truly deserve it? Wouldn't you like to think that any resources you inherited are rightfully yours as the descendant of fundamentally exceptional people? Of course you would. New research indicates that in order to justify your lifestyle, you might even adjust your ideas about the power of genes. The lower classes are not merely unfortunate, according to the upper classes. They are genetically inferior. In several experiments published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Michael Krauss of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and Dasher Keltner of the University of California at Berkeley explored what they call social class essentialism. Essentialism is the belief that surface differences between two groups of people or things can be explained by differences in fundamental identities. One sees categories as natural, discrete, and stable. Dogs have a certain dogness to them, and cats a certain catness. Researchers have found that people hold essentialist beliefs about generally biological categories, such as gender, race, and sexuality, as well as more cultural ones such as nationality, religion, and political orientation. Essentialism leads to stereotyping, prejudice, and a disinclination to mingle with outsiders. Krauss and Keltner wanted to know if we see social class as an essential category. They started by developing a scale for measuring essentialistic beliefs about class. A diverse group of American adults rated their endorsement of such statements as, I think even if everyone wore the same clothing, people would still be able to tell your social class. And it is possible to determine one's social class by examining their genes. On average, people rated the items a 3.43, where 1 means completely disagree and 7 means completely agree. They were right in the middle. Participants also gave a subjective rating from 1 to 10 of their own social class rank within their community based on education, income, and occupational status. The researchers found that higher social class was associated with greater social class essentialism. This pattern remained even after controlling for political orientation as well as objective measures of a participant's income and education level, indicating that one's sense of being above or below others, not one's actual resources, that drives the result. Krauss and Keltner looked deeper into the connection between social class and social class essentialism by testing participants' belief in a just world, asking them to evaluate such statements as, "I feel that people get what they are entitled to have." The psychologist Melvin Lerner developed just world theory in the 1960s, arguing that we're motivated to believe that the world is a fair place. The alternative, a universe where bad things happen to good people, is too upsetting, so we engage defense mechanisms such as blaming the victim. She shouldn't have dressed that way, or trusting that positive and negative events will be balanced out by karma, a form of magical thinking. Krauss and Keltner found that the higher people perceive their social class to be, the more strongly they endorse just world beliefs, and that this difference explained their increased social class essentialism. Apparently, if you feel that you're doing well, you want to believe success comes to those who deserve it, and therefore those of lower status must not deserve it. Incidentally, the argument that you deserve anything because of your genes is philosophically contentious. None of us did anything to earn our genes. Higher class Americans may well believe life is fair because they're motivated to defend their egos and lifestyle. But there's an additional twist to their greater belief in a just world. Numerous researchers have found that upper-class people are more likely to explain other people's behavior by appealing to internal traits and abilities, whereas lower-class individuals note circumstances and environmental forces. This matches reality in many ways for these respective groups. The rich do generally have the freedom to pursue their desires and strengths, while for the poor, external limitations often outnumber their opportunities. The poor realize they could have the best genes in the world and still end up working at McDonald's. The wealthy might not merely be turning a blind eye to such realities due to their personal experience. They might actually have a blind spot. Might? There is a grain of truth to social class essentialism. The few studies on the subject estimate that income, educational attainment, and occupational status are perhaps at least 10% genetic and maybe much more. It makes sense that talent and drive, some portion of which are related to genetic variation, contribute to success. But that's a far cry from saying it is possible to determine one's social class by examining his or her genes. Such a statement ignores the role of wealth inheritance, the social connections one shares with one's parents, or the educational opportunities family money can buy, not to mention strokes of good or bad luck that are not tied to karma. One repercussion of social class essentialism is a lack of forgiveness for criminals and cheaters. In one of Krauss and Keltner's experiments, subjects read one of two fake scientific articles. One reported that we genetically inherit our work ethic, intelligence, and ultimately our socioeconomic status. The other held that socioeconomic status has no genetic basis. Then the participants read scenarios about someone cheating on an academic exam and rated how much they endorsed various punishments, including restorative ones such as community service and ethics training. Those who read the essay supporting essentialism showed more resistance to restorative punishments. When people cheat the academic system, they unfairly ascend the social class hierarchy, Krauss says. Some of us might attribute a cheater's seeming subpar intelligence or preparation or integrity to upbringing and see room for improvement. An essentialist will see bad genes, and if you think people can't change, then there's no use in trying to help them. Do you see the mindset there? Krauss and Keltner think social class essentialism and the historically even more harmful race essentialism might push our justice system toward giving certain people long prison sentences instead of chances at rehabilitation. Spreading the notion that social categories are constructed could counteract the belief that lower-class people's behavior is genetically determined, and it could also lead to greater support for drug treatment programs, affirmative action, Head Start, and increased minimum wage, and multiple other causes benefiting the less affluent. Social class essentialism is basically inciting social Darwinism. This distortion of Darwin's theory of evolution, in one interpretation, is the belief that only the fit survive and thrive, and further that this process should be accepted or even accelerated by public policy. It's an example of the logical fallacy known as the appeal to nature. What is natural is good. If that were true, technology and medicine would be moral abominations. Social class essentialism entails belief in economic survival of the fittest as a fact. It might also entail belief in survival of the fittest as a desired end, given the results linking it to reduced support for restorative interventions. It's one thing to say those people can't change, so let's not waste our time. It's another to say those people can't change, so let's lock them away or eradicate them. Only 4 years ago, when Lieutenant Governor of South Carolina Andre Bauer told a small town meeting that poor people, like stray animals, should not be fed because they breed. Oh, God. Krauss's even more recent work, not yet published, goes beyond what high-status individuals believe in order to maintain the status hierarchy and explores what they do. Consider Congress. Members' median net worth in 2011 was $966,000. They are quite wealthy individuals, Krauss says, and because they're wealthy, they're likely to engage in not only these essentialistic mental processes, but these people actually have power to enact laws to maintain inequality. A top advisor to the UK's Education Secretary just produced a report arguing that discussions on issues such as social mobility entirely ignore genetics. Well, yeah, he claimed that school performance is as much as 70% genetic. And criticized England's Sure Start program as a waste of money. Oh, God, as Scott Barry Kaufman, an intelligence researcher at NYU and the author of Ungifted, points out, since genes are always interacting with environmental triggers, there is simply no way to parse how much of an individual child's performance is due to nature or nurture. It may be easy to demonize upper-class politicians as out of touch. Yes, it is. But given how easily Krauss and Keltner triggered social class essentialism in everyday Americans, and given the frequency with which we toss around terms like white trash, redneck, welfare queen, and across the pond, chav, we might want to question the degree to which we all see status as a marker of a deeper identity. If you were born under other circumstances, your resume might look very different. Privilege is often invisible, especially one's own. It's a very thought-provoking article. And now, I'd like to bring you a third article, kind of on the same subject. This is from Reason.com. Petty law enforcement versus the poor. How the state's desire to manage our movement harms the poor. By Brian Doherty. This is dated January 8, 2014. The New York Times recently noted a new trend in Los Angeles, strict enforcement of jaywalking laws downtown, including the little-known regulation that makes it a crime to enter a crosswalk after the red crosswalk light is flashing, even if that red light, as it often does in LA, is counting down the seconds until the light changes. A normal person might assume the city was giving you useful information to make an intelligent judgment as to whether you can make it across the street safely before the light changes. In effect, though, the countdown light is just entrapment to commit an expensive $197 infraction. The New York Times story focused on bourgeoisie downtown residents and shoppers. New York City itself is a city that manages to thrive despite pretty much never enforcing its own jaywalking laws. The story didn't mention that an earlier wave of jaywalking enforcement in Los Angeles began back in 2006 under the aegis of the Safe Cities Initiative. LA police had already been issuing over 1,000 tickets per month for jaywalking in the name of homeless management. A 2007 study from the UCLA law professor emeritus Gary Blasi, Policing Our Way Out of Homelessness, the first year of the Safer Cities Initiative on Skid Row, found such jaywalking or other petty citations given at rates 48 to 69 times those in the rest of the city. It noted that of the 1,000 people per month who receive citations and are unable to pay the fines, most will face subsequent arrest and jail, even though the original offense may have been littering or a pedestrian signal. Do you see where they're taking this? They're trying to throw more people in jail. Some of those ticketed were in wheelchairs or otherwise disabled, or pushing a cart full of all of their possessions in front of them as they tried to struggle across the street, says Pete White of Los Angeles Community Action Network, a poverty activist group. Blasi found the timing of Skid Row lights to be the absolute minimum imaginable for anyone to get across a street. As damaging as the fines themselves can be, says White, his group also hates strict pedestrian law enforcement because it's an excuse for search, harassment, and intimidation of the poor in a situation where a population of 13 to 15,000 people downtown were receiving nearly that many citations a year. Lawyer Carol Sobel, who helps represent many downtown LA residents who receive such citations, says you can often beat the rap if you go to court, usually because officers don't show up, or your lawyer can prove they gave a citation that wasn't legally warranted. But if you cannot beat the rap or pay the fine, that simple ticket for stepping off a curb can lead to an arrest warrant, which many activists think was in part the point of the city's crackdown to begin with, a component in a general plan of clearing the homeless out of downtown LA. Contemplating how something as simple as a ticket for a couple of $100 could effectively ruin a life reminded me of the last time I was in traffic court for driving a car in California with an expired license plate. I heard brief versions of the stories that brought dozens of my fellow citizens before the judge, some facing imprisonment, most just facing fines of more than $1,000 that could lead to imprisonment if not paid. Every single story that brought them there, overwhelmingly minorities, and my guess, based on their demeanor and stories, working class, began with a small fine for some traffic-related infraction that, not dispatched with prompt bourgeoisie responsibility, ballooned to larger fines and or arrest warrants. Do the crime, pay the fine, many might think. Why wouldn't they? Maybe the fine represented too large a part of their disposable income to be dealt with in time. Or maybe they just aren't that skilled at remembering to take care of expensive problems promptly. Imposing small fines for our often objectively harmless in and of itself behavior as we move through the world or through traffic is one of the most significant ways Americans interact with the state. Even if the fines don't balloon to bigger fines and eventual arrest warrants, such interactions open up Americans to violations of dignity, like being publicly jacked and handcuffed. Privacy, you are supposed to identify yourself and give the cops a chance to look into your background and possibly liberty. That's if the traffic stop degenerates into a search, and it's easy for cops to make that so. The Supreme Court decided in the 1996 case Wren versus U.S. that no matter what a cop's real motive for pulling you over was, even if he's really just scrabbling for an excuse to get a closer look at you or your car, if you in fact committed a moving violation, that's totally cool. As David A. Harris pointed out in a 1997 article in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology called Driving While Black and All Other Traffic Offense, the Supreme Court and Pretextual Traffic Stops, a driver is pretty much always committing a moving violation, since they can include actions as vague and open to interpretation as not giving full time and attention to the operation of the vehicle. That means that any citizen is fair game for a stop, almost any time, anywhere, virtually at the whim of police. Given how important an activity driving has become, Harris wrote, Wren changes the Fourth Amendment's rule that police must have a reason to forcibly interfere in our business. As Harris goes on to note, and as many studies have indicated, that is going to have a disproportionate effect on minorities, which given American socioeconomics can mean a disproportionate effect on the poor, as will the state's demands that we pay them off in various ways for permission to drive, a core element of modern working life for many. Tom Nordley, a former assistant public defender in Florida in the 1990s, and disclosure, an old college buddy, remembers nearly a third of misdemeanor cases he represented involved people driving with licenses suspended. A first offense could net 2 months in jail and a $500 fine, even though the crime did not necessarily cause any harm to anyone. In the world of misdemeanor crimes, many offenses come about because people are impulsive, drug-addicted, cruel, or avaricious, Nordley says. Most DWLS cases don't happen for any of those reasons. DWLS cases come about because people are poor, or at the very least because they don't manage their money well. DWLS is more strongly linked to economics than any other misdemeanor offense. It frequently occurred because of unpaid tickets or lack of insurance. I had many clients tell me I had to keep working to have a chance to raise the money I needed to fix this situation, and in order to work, I had to drive. Bam! It's a DWS charge waiting to happen. Nordley knows there are situations where someone needs to stop driving due to demonstrated incompetence or disregard for other people's safety, but in my experience, those situations represent only a small fraction of DWLS cases. UCLA's Donald Shoup, wizard of parking, whose controversial policy proposal is to hugely raise the price of parking, has written on the idea of graduated parking fines in recognition of the fact that in his survey of Los Angeles 1 year, 8% of ticketed cars generated 29% of tickets. Shoup isn't moved by the idea that parking or other violations might disproportionately harm the poor. Lots of people just think, I got a ticket and I'm aggravated, so I'll say they hurt the poor more, Shoup says. It's like pushing poor people in front of themselves like human shields. Nevertheless, the graduated fine idea could be used to give a break to the working poor or destitute, and could also be applied to moving violations to keep people from losing jobs or ending up in jail over what are ultimately no or pretty low harm crimes. For those who fear traffic mayhem, absent strict enforcement of moving violation fines, a study by Shoup, published in a 1973 issue of Journal of Transport Economics and Policy, is tantalizing. He found that in a controlled experiment in Los Angeles in 1968, having motorcycle cops merely observe from a visible place and take no action produced only a 1% rise in injury accidents over a control period. Switching the cop to a policy of approaching violators but merely warning them led to a 13% decrease in injury accidents. Perhaps rugged fine-based enforcement isn't necessary for a civilized and safe roadway. Macro data on the specific effect of parking and traffic fines and laws on the poor don't seem to exist. Blasi, the UCLA law professor who studied the effects of jaywalking enforcement in LA, says it's almost impossible to get any kind of data on peer citations. It's not part of national crime reporting. Gathering data or dreaming of policy fixes for to stop the pettiest end of state law enforcement from ruining the lives of the poor isn't a high priority for academics or even most activists. Blasi says, except those representing people on the street, like LA Community Action Network, I don't think anyone pays any attention to policing that seems minor. He explains, it's minor to someone like you or me, but to other folks, not at all minor. Brian Doherty is a senior editor at Reason Magazine and author of Ron Paul's Revolution, The Man and the Movement He Inspired, from Broadside Books. And that's all I got for today.
Maybe you were born with a silver spoon, got a good education, a career real soon. Not everybody had that advantage, but we get by and we still manage. You learn to appreciate the littlest things. The smallest kindness makes your heart take wing. It makes you kinder to those you know. There's nothing in the world like being poor. You learn to make do with what you got. You see the gap between the have and have not. You learn to save and not to waste, and you're never full. You get just a taste. Lives to get out of debt and never quite make it. You can't bet. You stay close to the ground, your feet on the floor. There's nothing in the world like being poor. Suffering everywhere I see. Well-off people just turn their heads. They'd rather not see that source of dread. We may be poor in pocket, but not in heart. We can help each other, and that's a start. I don't want a handout. I want to find work. I'm not one of them layabout jerks. Get a leg up and go out and play. But if I ever come knocking on your front door, remember, there's nothing in the world